While there are many Americans who would say openly that they oppose the war in Iraq, and others who would at least express misgivings and mixed feelings, it does seem to be the case that there is widespread support for American soldiers who are serving overseas. In spite of that high level of support, there are many veterans who say that they face some serious problems in receiving medical care and benefits that they are owed, and also in working through their experiences in combat once they come home. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk a little bit about the current state of veterans affairs. And our guest for the program is Max Cleland. He is a former senator from Georgia. Currently, he is a member of the board of directors of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. He has quite a lot of experience in government at the state and national levels. He was, in 2002, appointed to the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States to report findings and recommendations to prevent future attacks. He ran successfully for the United States Senate from Georgia, taking the seat that had been held by Sam Nunn when he retired. He, under President Jimmy Carter, was the head of the U.S. Veterans Administration. In fact, he was the youngest person ever to have that job. He volunteered for duty in Vietnam. He was promoted to the rank of captain in 1968. He was seriously wounded in a grenade explosion that year, and that cost him both legs and his right arm. For his service, he was awarded the Bronze Star and a Silver Star. He also had government experience in Georgia. He served as the youngest Secretary of State in the state's history and also the youngest member of the Georgia State Senate. He's joining us this morning by telephone. We're pleased to have him with us. And, of course, questions, comments from people who are listening are welcome, too. The only thing we ask of people who call is that they just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, getting as many people as possible. But, of course, questions and comments from listeners are welcome. That's what the show is all about. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Cleland, hello.
Well, good morning. Wow, what a great introduction. I'm not sure I can live up to all of that you said. It's great to talk to you and your wonderful program. It has a national reputation and a wonderful audience, and I'm just honored to be part of it. I was in the Champaign-Urbana area in the last days of the campaign of last year, campaigning for Barack Obama, and I saw him the other night, and I said, I'm going to be on that wonderful Southern Illinois radio station, and he says, take care of me. I think Dick Durbin would say the same thing. I would say that Illinois has really two great members of the United States Senate, my friend Dick Durbin, who is now the deputy minority leader and a tremendous spokesperson for the programs that make the lives of Americans more hopeful. And Barack Obama has just taken the Senate and the country in many ways by storm, being the first African-American elected, actually only the third in the Senate's history since the Civil War. So you have really two great members of the United States Senate, and it was great to be in the Urbana area for Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And you got a great part of the world there.
Well, we think so, too. We appreciate you giving us some of your time here this morning. Well, you know, recently I have certainly been reading stories, and in part this is because the subject has been discussed on Capitol Hill. That is how well we are serving the needs of veterans. And I was struck, however, by a story. I believe this appeared in Newsday, and it was a story about some veterans, people who had served in Iraq recently, and they were speaking at a community college, and this was at Nassau Community College, and they were talking with college students there, and presumably some of the students they were talking to were thinking about whether or not they might want to join the military and think about that as a career. And I was very struck by some of the comments of a young woman who was identified here as a former private in the Army. And here's what she said. She said, a lot of people praise the dead for being heroes, but people forget about the living who returned. You always see those bumper stickers that say, support the troops. I'm a living troop. I'm tired of seeing those words. Where's the action? Now, I'm sure that this young woman, this former private, would say that that people who lost their lives serving should be honored. I'm sure she wasn't intending to say anything like that, but she seemed to be experiencing the kind of frustration that one hears, and I see it in various newspaper accounts, from people who have served and have come back and say they're having a difficult time with getting health care and other kinds of benefits. And, you know, now the VA is still having a difficult time, I think, struggling somewhat to take care of the health needs of people who served in World War II and in Korea and Vietnam. And now they're expecting that they will again have a new bunch of people that they're going to have to take care of. And it seems to raise some questions about our commitment to veterans and whether we're going to be able to meet that commitment.
Well, you put it out there on the table, all of it, and it would take more than 53 minutes. It'd take more like 53 hours to go into it. Maybe I can talk about war for just a moment. Mm-hmm. That private coming back from war, having been shot at, expresses the view, I think, that is universal after one goes to war and is exposed to combat and has been shot at. There's a great line out of the book, All Quiet on the Western Front, written by a German private in World War I. In the Battle of the Trenches, he was lucky to survive and came back and wrote a book, All Quiet on the Western Front. The opening frontispiece of the book says this, that war is not an adventure for those who are being shot at. I talked to an Iraqi veteran 2 days ago. He came home and noticed that those who had not been to war said, we appreciate you for supporting our country. And that was a genuine, heartfelt expression. Those who had been to war looked at him and said, how are you? And therein lies the difference. And I appreciate everyone with their wonderful bumper sticker or sign that says, support our troops. When I came back from Vietnam, there were no such signs in 1968. The signs were all students who were exposed to the draft in those days, demonstrating on college campuses, burning up administration buildings, war protests with hundreds of thousands of people around the country, and you felt like you had just landed on Mars and not your own nation. And in many ways, that was the beginning of a powerful disconnect between Vietnam veterans and their country. And that disconnect still continues. What I see in these Iraqi veterans coming back is that same disconnect. Although there are no college campus demonstrations, there are some silent vigils. I went to Central Florida last year and saw a vigil where there were just well over 1,100 combat boots empty, lined up in rows in formation, now symbolizing the dead. Now there should be over 1,500 pairs of combat boots with no one in them, and the death toll continues every day. But there's a powerful disconnect, increasingly, between this country and its warriors. The country here in this war is not into it. We receive the evening news, which is usually traumatic and discouraging, and we get bombarded with that. But for the private that's coming back, they've been to war. They've been shot at. And war is not an adventure. It is not some glorious, great escapade to remake the Middle East into our image. It is a fight for life and death. Therein lies the powerful challenge for this country and for, shall we say, the Veterans Administration. Hmm. The challenge starts with the fact that there is no exit strategy in Iraq. There was no exit strategy in Vietnam. And you pour in more troops and things continue to get worse. Now, for Vietnam veterans like me, that we've seen this movie before. I was over at Walter Reed yesterday and talked to a young Iraqi veteran. He's going back for his third tour, one tour in Afghanistan, one tour in Iraq. He's going back to Iraq again. He's a sergeant. He's a squad leader in infantry. He has been blown up The concussion from an IED, that's what the Army calls a bomb that they don't know where it came from, improvised explosive device, messed up his insides. But his insides and his intestines is not his problem. It's his psychological insides, his emotional insides. And therein, he is in a post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, clinic at Walter Reed, and suffering from emotional distress and going back for his third tour. He says he feels like he is in a field where he and his squad are alone, and the helicopter has left, and he gets a call over the radio that says, nobody coming for you. That's a recurring dream he has. So the fear and the trauma of being blown up in war is something that veterans bring home, whether it's Vietnam, World War I, or Iraq. The problem is this administration and this VA have not properly provided for that. And they have cut, in the president's budget, about 3,000 nurses. They have raised the cost of prescription drugs for all veterans, whether it's World War II, Korea, Vietnam, or Desert Storm, or Iraq veterans. And they are pulling funding for contracting for psychological counseling in rural America. And at 50% of the casualties are coming from rural America. We are in deep trouble because we have no friends there in Iraq. No international friends and support. Now we're there alone. We can't do it alone. And secondly, there's no exit strategy. And third, more and more, it's painfully obvious. The rationale for the war was false. There are no weapons of mass destruction. There is no tie to Al-Qaeda who came after us on September the 11th. So more and more, these veterans coming back are feeling alone, frustrated, not knowing what their country's thinking, and they're saying, oh, my goodness, I may have to turn around and go back. It's this endless treadmill that they're on with no resolution that creates the massive trauma that these veterans are feeling and the massive disconnect that they feel with their own experience and with the country. We're in deep trouble. We're burning out our American military, and we don't have the funds in the VA to take care of them when they come home. That's the gist of it.
Mm. If you take a look at the budget for the Department of Veterans Affairs, you can see over the past few years, it seems that there has been a steady sort of increase in the amount of money that's allocated to take care of soldiers and former soldiers. However, if you look at where we are now, as you say, look at where we are now and what they're projecting in the next couple of years, it's almost zero growth. In the past, I think that the Congress has certainly regarded the veterans as an important constituency and wanted to take care of them. But the White House, while they're spending more money on defense, it seems that they're not really allocating much in the way of increases for taking care of veterans. Where does this go? After all, the Congress, they have the power of the purse. Is this something that you think the Congress can do something about or would do something about?
And should. Because and quite frankly, the president, as commander-in-chief, should take care of this. If you send young Americans to war, I don't care whether it's Vietnam, World War II, World War I, Desert Storm, Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, you've got to plan for casualties. You've got to plan for the emotional and physical needs of these veterans when they come home. If you don't, you are committing an immoral act. You're sending these young Americans to die and bleed for their country, which they are willing to do, but you're not being honest with them about this country taking care of them when they come back. It is wonderful to have bumper stickers. Don't misunderstand me. I would much rather have that than war anti-war demonstrations. But when you get down to it, you can't be the commander-in-chief and say you're doing a good job when you propose a VA health care budget that cuts out of the VA 3,000 nurses. And that when you raise the cost of prescription drugs in the VA for all veterans, and when you do not provide for a permanent increase in the United States Army, that you are burning out and wiping out, because this force on the ground in Iraq will soon be 50% of Guard and Reserve. And in the last 3 months, the Guard, in terms of its recruitment, has dropped 30%. The general in charge of the Army Reserves has said it's a broken force, and that was about a month ago. It is getting worse. General Barry McCaffrey, the most decorated general alive today, and won his spurs in Vietnam and his Silver Stars in Vietnam and Desert Storm, a retired four-star general, says the wheels are going to start coming off the Army, and within 2 years, it will be pretty much decimated. So you cannot continue to burn out the Army in this open-ended conflict and then not provide for the expansion of the Army enough ground troops in the initial commitment to do the job, or fail to expand the Army now, because you cannot occupy Iraq if you maintain only the current force. You cannot depend on Guard and Reserve, because young men and women are not signing up when they come back for the Guard and Reserve, and those forces are decreasing. And also, you cannot say you're taking care of the troops when you cut nursing care in the VA health care system and when you cut counseling programs that deal with the emotional aftermath of war. So we are in deep trouble. Now, what happens, too, here in a terrorist environment, is one who got blown up and lost both legs and my right arm with a grenade explosion, at least to a certain extent, we saw some of the enemy in Vietnam. Here, you don't see anything at all. You just feel the explosion and the missing legs and the missing body parts, and your buddy's dead, blind, bleeding all over you. Now, that is terror. And those who are wounded by it are impacted powerfully, but those who are standing by are terrorized by it. And so now it is estimated that 1 in 6 soldiers in Iraq are coming back with major depression, serious anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. The number, just by the end of the year, could exceed 170,000 of our Iraqi veterans. There is no way the VA or even the United States Army or the Navy is able to handle that. So we are creating this massive explosion of young veterans coming back that are going to need services, and they're going to have to deal with their own terror for the rest of their lives, and we need to make sure they get help.
We are talking this morning with Max Cleland. He is a former head of the U.S. Veterans Administration. That was during the Carter administration. He also served in the United States Senate from Georgia. Right at the moment, he is member of the board of directors of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. He was nominated to that job by the president and was confirmed by the Senate. He'll be serving until January of 2007. He's been good enough to come and spend some time with us this morning to talk about veterans affairs, and questions are certainly welcome. We have someone ready to go in Chicago. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Let's talk with our Chicago listener on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I found the message from the lady private, or from the woman private, interesting, because this is not a new problem. I don't know if people realized it or not, but Audie Murphy suffered from, I guess back then they called it combat fatigue. He won just about every medal they could give him, and he was going to go to West Point, but he was wounded and had to leave the service, but he always suffered from that and never got treated for it. And so I don't know if very many people knew that or not, but all through his life he had this problem. I guess it's true going back all the way to the Revolutionary War, if you want to trace it back that far. But what I wanted to ask Mr. Cleland was, during the World War II period, there were about 1,104 women who served in the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, Women Air Service Pilots, and about 38 of these women were killed doing their duty, and they did not get the GI insurance. And I wanted to know, was that ever corrected?
Later on it was, because those women should have gotten and should be entitled to full benefits, as if they were in combat. I'm familiar with with that case, and the Congress did in the 70s, as I understand it, ultimately give them full benefit. They earned it, and they deserved it.
That's right. These women were, in a lot of ways, they were discriminated against. The discrimination that they faced was very similar to what the African American soldier.
Exactly.
Faced. And
it was of the same ilk. It was the same sense that, well, maybe women can ferry planes in World War II here behind the lines, but they're not good enough for combat. Now we have women flying Cobra helicopters and jets off aircraft carriers, as you well know. And the black community was very segregated from the white community in the military.
Well, you know, there was some controversy back then. should we integrate the women's divisions or the women's units, they decided not to because they were worried that if they got pressure to do that, that they would have to integrate the male units as well.
And Harry Truman in 1947, of course, integrated the, by executive order the United States Armed Forces.
That's right.
Properly so. And now women serve in all branches of the American military and in all roles except in the Army. They don't serve in the three combat arms, infantry, armor, and artillery, but they serve in every other capacity.
That's right. Okay, thank you.
All right, let's come back here to someone in our area in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yes. My question doesn't in any way mean to underrate the personal suffering of war veterans, but what will the social costs of undertreated and, or untreated war veterans be?
Tremendous social cost. I will say to you my own personal example. The reason I saw that veteran yesterday is that I'm going back to Walter Reed for my own trauma counseling 36 years later. I came through Walter Reed when they were fortunate just to treat the physical wounds and not the emotional wounds. Later, when I was head of the VA, I created the Vet Center program, the counseling program, in 1980 with the help of President Carter and Senator Alan Cranston from California. But now I find I never thought I had PTSD. But those people who go through trauma, certainly war trauma, carry it with them, that imprint, that trauma imprint in their psyche for the rest of their lives. I now understand that. And I've been over in my own counseling. So it's a very surrealistic experience for me to go to Walter Reed now and meet with a veterans, with a trauma counselor that teaches me about my own trauma and how it has affected my life and how I see life and how I react to life. And then to walk out the door and see young men missing arms and legs and see young Iraqi veterans in there for physical training, PT, and new limbs, and their own trauma counseling. At least at Walter Reed, they're seeing the PTSD cases up front. They're teaching them about how it affects their lives and how it affects how they see life. And that's a good thing. We know more about trauma now and the impact of war on our veterans than ever before. That's why I think it's inexcusable to ignore the fact that probably 170,000 of our veterans coming back from Iraq by the end of this year will have some form of major depression, serious anxiety, or PTSD. All of that is produced by trauma. When you send people into a terrorist environment, they are never safe. Never. That's the feeling I had in Vietnam. That's the feeling these young Iraqi veterans have when they come back and they talk to me. That feeling is the same. Now, we knew this feeling in various ways and by various terms. Out of the Civil War, it was called the soldier's mind, M-I-N-D. Out of World War I, it was called shell shock. Out of World War II, combat fatigue. But by late 1970, with the Vietnam experience, and tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of veterans coming back from that war, a terrorist environment for over 10 years that we had there. By 1978, when I was head of the VA, we put together the diagnosis PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. That means after the original trauma, stress continues and can pop up years later, as it has in my own life 36 years later, regarding the original trauma, when it's triggered by other events. Here's what's happening with a lot of Vietnam veterans. This Iraq war is triggering their experiences and their sense of terror and reminding them of their own experience, and they're going into counseling. It's an amazing thing here. But we now know what war does to people. It is not an adventure. It is a battle for survival. And when you get wounded or are near a wounding situation, you never forget it, and you carry it with you.
Yes, and fortunately for you, at the very least, you've been superficially extremely successful. I'm not sure that all people with post-traumatic stress would have that that result.
Well, what I find is that if I have a positive goal in life, and I think it works for me and I think it works for others, then the trauma recedes in my own mind and in my own life. I don't focus on the trauma or the pain or the hurt. I focus on the goal and the objective. But when I don't have that goal, Mm-hmm. Well, I'm like a kid riding a bicycle, and he stops, and the bicycle falls over. I find in my own life, in order to properly cope with my stuff, my physical injuries and my emotional stuff from all that, that I need a positive, healthy goal that keeps me focused and positive in life. Otherwise, the anxiety, the emotional distress, the triggers have a tendency to overwhelm me. I never knew this about myself, but since I lost the race in 2002, I've learned a lot about depression, anxiety, PTSD, and stuff. That's why I identify with these young Iraqi veterans so much. Now, here's an environment. Think about this environment. 85% of the casualties in Iraq come about through explosive devices. I don't know whether you've ever had, like, your life shattered in some way, either by a death or of a loved one or injury or divorce or something that shattered your life and your sense of justice and safety and security. But if you are around an explosive device and it goes off and you are affected physically, mentally, and emotionally, you never forget it. You carry that with you. And these 85% of these casualties are due to explosive devices. That's when life blows up unexpectedly.
Well,
and then you got
to
deal with it.
Our life has blown up since September 11th in the Bush administration, but I think it's hard to have positive goals in this atmosphere. But thank you very, very much for your work, and keep going.
All right. Well, thanks for the
call.
Thank
you very much.
I think this raises a point in one of the things that I wanted to ask you about. I think that there are some people who would suggest that there is a group here that has been almost rendered almost invisible. And while we have certainly acknowledged in a public way people who have been killed in Iraq, that we really have not acknowledged those people who were wounded, perhaps profoundly wounded, have returned seriously disabled. It's a number I think even the journalists who are interested in this question have had a hard time actually finding out how many of these people there are. And I wonder what you think about that and whether you think that in not acknowledging that, we have made a mistake.
You know, a veteran wants to be looked at and acknowledged as a veteran, not a victim. And they want to be acknowledged as nothing more, nothing less. Not as a big hero, not anything less than a veteran. They want to be acknowledged. So public acknowledgement of your service and sacrifice is what we ought to be doing. But what is happening here is this. Any administration, whether it was Lyndon Johnson or George Bush, has tended to cover up the cost of war in fiscal terms and in budgetary terms. The president's budget this time around does not include the cost of the Iraq War. Unbelievable. And it's now cost us over $300 billion and counting. The president's budget doesn't include it. It's buried in the $400 billion defense budget authorization. So it's hard to break it out. It's hard to find out what the war really is costing us. Now, 2 years ago, he gave everybody a sticker shock by saying he needed an extra $887 billion. Now there'll be another supplemental coming along a few months from now, more money. And we're just pouring it in, good money after bad. And what we got here is a runaway train with no exit strategy. And yet, it is producing, anonymously almost, casualties. All the casualties that are killed come back into Dover, Delaware, at night on a big C-5. And the press is not allowed to take pictures of those caskets. Secondly, the wounded come into Andrews Air Force Base first here to go to Walter Reed or Bethesda if they're Marine Corps. It's the Bethesda Navy Hospital. They come in at night. Now, the difference between me coming back 36 years ago and being put on a stretcher and put in an ambulance and hauled out to Walter Reed at night is that there's Vietnam veterans there, there's the Order of the Military Purple Heart, and some people there that make it a point to meet these flights coming into Andrews, and they come in how frequently? For 3 nights a week during the Battle of Fallujah, they came in about 18 flights in 1 week. And so what you have here is, in many ways, in the dark of night, our boys and girls come home. They're either dead or wounded. And there's no press cameras there. There's no real acknowledgement of that except by a few on the ground, who thank God they're on the ground, saying welcome home. And then maybe the next time we see them is maybe on a TV special on amputees at Walter Reed, but they tend to blend into the woodwork, you see. And that is very difficult, very difficult. We have a disconnect between this war and its costs, both budgetarily and personally. We have a disconnect. And one of the major reasons for the disconnect is that we went through such a painful war in the Vietnam War that in 1973, President Nixon could not renew the draft. So these youngsters in college out there and of draft age are not being drafted. So they're not focused on it. You're only focused on the Iraq War in many ways if you are personally involved and have some loved one there. And that's a shame. The whole country is committed here, and we better pay attention to the costs of this candle, because ultimately, as this war drags on, the American people increasingly will feel that the cost is not worth the candle. And how do you turn around and tell that to somebody that lost both their legs and are trying to learn how to walk over at Walter Reed? This is the bind we're in. And how do you tell that to a veteran who's walking around with PTSD and doesn't even know it and is suffering from massive anxiety attacks, major depression, and messing up their life, and they don't exactly understand what happened to them. And yet they're part of the silent warriors that we have back in our country. And they're coming back by the thousands every day. And yet, because of our military policies, and we haven't expanded the Army, and the Guard and Reserve are going down in numbers, we're having to send the same people back. I can't believe it was my worst nightmare. Matter of fact, I've had this dream since Vietnam, that somehow I was on my fifth or sixth tour, and I was tired, and it was time to tell the personnel officer, I can't do this anymore. That was part of my dream. So that soldier I met yesterday at Walter Reed, who's in PTSD counseling, he's going back for his third tour. This thing is a never-ending battle, and we're burning out our Army, and we're burning out our families. And that's gonna ultimately destroy the United States Army, because people are not going to put up with it. It's an all-volunteer force now. They can't just turn right around and draft people. Matter of fact, the Congress would not approve a draft because the American people are opposed to a draft, because they don't want their sons and daughters over there doing this. So we are caught in a catch-22. We have no exit strategy, and we should have figured that out up front and early. We don't have enough troops on the ground to secure the population, and therefore General Shinseki was right when he said it would take 500,000 troops. That was the original Pentagon plan for invading Iraq. If you're going to go in and do regime change, you've got to have 500 troops on the ground to secure the population. Why? Because in a guerrilla environment, the center of gravity, the military center of gravity, is the population. You've got to secure the population and give them security. Otherwise, you'll never isolate the guerrillas. So we are on the strategic defensive in Iraq, just like we're on the strategic defensive in Vietnam. We set ourselves up for a fall, and we saw that for 10 years in Vietnam. I was there, and I saw it in 67 and 68 with the Tet Offensive and the siege of Khe Sanh, where I got wounded. And now we're seeing it in Iraq. Yesterday, 150 Iraqis were killed with a suicide bomber. You cannot defend against suicide bombers. You got to isolate them up front. And until you secure the population, you can't isolate the guerrillas. So we're in deep trouble. And this thing is way out of control.
We have some other callers. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus, and I would like to quickly introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking this morning with Max Cleland. He served, as he has said, he served in Vietnam. He volunteered. He was seriously wounded. He lost both legs and his right arm for his service. He received the Bronze Star and Silver Star. He's been involved in a number of capacities at the state and national levels in government under President Jimmy Carter. He served as head of the Veterans Administration, was the youngest person ever to have that job. He also was the youngest Secretary of State in the history of Georgia and the youngest member of the State Senate in Georgia. He ran successfully for the United States Senate in 1995, taking over the seat that had been held by Sam Nunn, who was retiring. He is currently a member of the Board of Directors of the Export-Import Bank of the United States, and he's with us by phone. We do have several people who are on here, and we'll try to get as many as we can, and folks who are calling in also can help us by being brief as much as they can in their comments. Let's go to line two. It's next. It's someone in Charleston. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Cleland. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I, too, am a Vietnam veteran, and after a hard day at the office, I picked up my best buddy with a litter spoon, put him in a cigarette pack, and then found out about Kent State. So it was a very hard day at the office that day. I want to thank you for everything that you're doing and for bringing this up. I hit my own wall about 5 years after I got back and became very self-destructive. I think our main problem is that we have an administration that humiliated and threw out the only person who really had any idea of what war was, and that these people think sitting back in an armchair and putting magnets on the back of your car is supporting the troops without having any idea of what they're facing. For me, the worst part of the war was not necessarily what I saw and what I did. The worst part for me was what I learned about myself, what I learned, what's lurking underneath there, my attitudes towards what I did and how I was able to deal with it at the time. And that really left me with a very sorry taste in my mouth and an opinion that I think my mother would have been very disappointed, because I, you know, you come back essentially a sociopath, a highly disciplined sociopath. And I find that very troubling, and we have to deal with this right now. And these people who are having parades, who are giving the parades, have no idea that after the parade's over, the people for whom they're giving the parade have to deal with that. And they're not going to be able to sleep any better than we do. So I want to thank you for everything you're doing.
Well, thank you for the call. And my brother, God bless you, and welcome home. I heard a line the other day from a Vietnam veteran, and I think the Iraqi veterans can maybe identify with it, that that every day that he was in Vietnam, he thought about home, and every day he was home, he thought about Vietnam. That's the sense in which these defining moments in our lives stay with us. Now, one thing to hopefully make you feel a little bit better, I hope. In combat, we did what we had to do to survive. What I'm learning in my trauma counseling is that some of those behaviors are not needed now, and I have to let go of some of this stuff. We were exposed to combat, to tremendous threat to ourselves, a tremendous stress, and that's the nature of combat. And so we adopted a fight or flight attitude, or freeze. The freeze was put your emotions on hold until you survive. Now therein lies the emotional disconnect, and then years later, you try to come to terms with it. I know that, and you know that. And these Iraqi veterans are going through the same thing. That's why you have post-trauma counseling available from them as they come home, certainly through the Veterans Administration Vet Center program. This administration ought to be expanding the Vet Center counseling program into every part of America, especially into rural America, where 50% of these soldiers are from, and they're not doing that. That's immoral. And so when you talk about moral values, this is where I feel that there's a massive disconnect here. You spend $400 billion a year on defense, and yet you can't come up with money enough for the VA, and you got to cut 3,000 nurses, and you can't come up to, with enough money to expand the Army, and you're depending on extending 100,000 reservists for the next 3 to 5 years. That does not make any sense at all. And you slash $9 million from medical and prosthetic research this year. That doesn't make any sense at all. So we have a reckoning coming, and it's not going to be pleasant.
Well, I want to thank you for everything you've done, you're doing for the Iraqi veterans and for the dignity and integrity you've given to all veterans. Thank you very much for your efforts, sir.
Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you for the call. Let's continue. We'll go next to someone listening in Champaign. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello, Senator. My question to you, and I'm a Vietnam-era veteran with duty in Germany, but I have known Vietnam veterans who suffer from many of the physical and mental impairments you referred to, and some who didn't come back in my community. And it's an African-American Southern Arkansas community. So African-Americans have been disproportionately affected by these reckless policies as well. I think my question to you is whether or not the indifference that we see now with the policymakers in Washington, including the President and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and the American people that have made what I think David referred to as this being an invisible war, does that go back to the fact that we have Volar, or what some people would say, we have mercenaries serving in our armed forces now, and as a result, they don't really count as much as they counted, say, when we were in Vietnam, and we all had all of this havoc being wreaked here at home because they were draftees?
You hit the nail on the head. There's good news and bad news about an all-volunteer force, and I kind of liked the all-volunteer force, and one of the reasons I liked it was that I didn't, first of all, it could be more professional, and that's a good thing, but that no president or no Congress could commit an all-volunteer force, certainly as small as ours, to some open-ended conflict without devastating negative impact on the country and on the Army. So I supported the all-volunteer force. But the downside to that is that there is an increasing disconnect between the Army and where it's committed and how it's committed and the American population, especially the young Americans who would normally would be draft age and feel deeply the sense of threat to their college life or their work life or their married life. Or so if there was a policy of a war abroad where they were directly required to go, then all of a sudden that becomes personal, just like it was in the Vietnam War. And so the Vietnam War, in effect, poisoned the draft because Lyndon Johnson and McNamara abused the draft. They called up, you talk about the African-American community, they called up 100,000 young men who were not up to the, shall we say, physical, mental, and emotional standards of the Army. They lowered the standards to get cannon fodder and throw them into Vietnam. And that later became tremendous AWL problems, tremendous drug problems, and so forth. The point being, the Army has already lowered its standards now to try to meet its recruitment goals. You cannot lower your standards for the all-volunteer force just to get warm bodies to throw into the desert in Iraq. That's immoral. And so you can't just lower your standards and throw people into combat that aren't really able to deal with it. So we are coming to this reckoning here where you're going to depend on Guard, National Guard, and reserves to be 50% of the force in Iraq, and now the president's talking about invading Iran. Where in the world are we going to get the troops? You're going to have to either adopt a draft in another year or two, or you're going to have to dramatically increase the all-volunteer force by several hundred thousand, or get out of Iraq. I mean, you got to do one or the other. We're on a train wreck here, and so it doesn't make any sense to be on this course, this open-ended course, without troops. What if the old adage in the late '60s, which you may remember, suppose they gave a war and nobody came? We're nearing that point because it is an all-volunteer force, and there is a powerful disconnect here with American society. And the all-volunteer force is saying, wait a minute, I've been there one tour, two tours, three tours, and I'm not going back anymore. As a matter of fact, in the state of Vermont, I heard yesterday, the citizens are petitioning the governor and the president not to send the Vermont National Guard back to Iraq, because per capita, they've taken more casualties than any other state. Now, that's a citizens' movement in the state of Vermont to petitioning leadership in this country saying, don't send our Guard troops there anymore. We need them at home, and we do need them at home.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right, well, thank you for the call. Let's go again to another caller. This next person in line is someone listening in Chicago up there and on line 4, our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. I've heard that 40% of the homeless population is Vietnam veterans, and I had a real unpleasant surprise last month because in the Christian Science Monitor there was a photograph of a homeless veteran from Iraq, which, you know, only started in 2003. My question is, you said we haven't paid the cost yet. I think that we're already paying the cost as a country because these men don't even have basic social services available to them because those budgets have had to be cut. And so in addition to the fact that the veterans' benefits are being cut, just the simple social services that are available to all Americans are being cut. And we're on a train wreck within the country as well.
That's a powerful point. You and I are both too young, but my daddy remembers it. Shall we say the hobos of the Great Depression? Most of the hobos that rode the rails and scraped for food and battled to survive were World War I veterans who were promised a bonus when they came back, and the bonus marchers marched on the Capitol here in the early 30s. Did not get the bonus. Matter of fact, it was Herbert Hoover that ran him out with General Major MacArthur and Captain Patton. They ran the bonus marchers out, and they hit the rails, and they became the hobos or the homeless of the 30s. And only World War II, in many ways, kind of brought the economy back and put many of them back to work. What we saw after the Vietnam War was that many veterans just went underground. They lived on the street, or lived in separate communities, and there are communities around America because of these young men can't relate to society and they got their own PTSD stuff, that they're just living by themselves. They're isolating, as the term goes. And I've talked to an Iraqi veteran friend of mine in New York, and he already has the names of 12 homeless Iraqi veterans that are living on the streets of New York as we speak. Yeah. This is disastrous. And these young men and some women come back out of terror, out of confusion, with their military going on and on and on and on with no exit strategy, no sense of real accomplishment, and their buddies getting blown up. They come back with that terror, and they encounter major depression, serious anxiety, and PTSD, and they hit the streets, and they isolate, and they survive as best they can. That's the root of the homeless problem from a veteran's point of view, and you're right. 40% of the homeless in America are those who served our country honorably, which is a national tragedy.
Well, thank you for what you're doing. Keep speaking out, because unfortunately, every time one of the national senators go over to Iraq, they come back and they sprout the party line, and I think we need more honesty. So thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. I saw what I assume is the same article in the Monitor that the caller was talking about. At least I have one here in front of me that says, according to this story, that it's estimated that 500,000 veterans were homeless at some time during 2004. Now, it doesn't really source this, although in the next graph they do quote have a quote from the executive director of an organization called the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans. So that it may be where it came from. I don't know. But do you think, in fact, that that's a reasonable number? 500,000 homeless vets at some time last year?
I do. And the reason is this. Many women have some social services backing them up, particularly if they have children. Men who are unattached, who have their own problems and not having a job and suffering their own stuff, hit the streets or live under the bridges. Many of these men have been in the American military. The challenge is just another challenge for the Veterans Administration to deal with the emotional aftermath of war, which is why I created the Vet Center program in 1980, to deal with the emotional aftermath of the war. It was the first time that we had really dealt with that in this country. And now to see these vet centers cut back, to see contract counseling in rural areas cut back, is a disaster, because this country is going to be flooded. All of our communities, with the war in Iraq, are going to be flooded with young men and some women coming back and struggling with how to fit in, how to deal with their experience of trauma and terror, and how to deal with the experience of seeing their buddies blown up, and for what? With their other friends going back for their second and third and fourth tour. And for their buddies at home to not understand and say, you know, I got my bumper sticker on my car where I support the troops, that's a powerful disconnect with these young men and women. They just don't identify with that. And they go underground and they deal with their stuff the best way they can. The VA needs to be expanding these services, not cutting them back. And we need to make sure that the Congress gets that message.
I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time for the hour. I have some callers we can't take. My apologies to them. I'm sure we could continue to talk. I wish we had the time, but we'll simply have to say thanks. Max Gleeland is the former head of the Veterans Administration. That was under the Carter administration. He also served in the United States Senate from Georgia. He was elected in 1995. Currently, he's a member of the board of directors of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. Senator, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. What a privilege it is to discuss these issues with you, but for a wonderful group of citizens in America who really care. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.